Welcome to the Blue Stocking Circle podcast, Lady Nerds on Popular Culture. We're your hosts, Bea,
Grisel,
and Ashley.
This is episode 3, The Tenth Kingdom. In today's episode, we will be discussing the 2000 television miniseries, The Tenth Kingdom, a modern fairy tale that explores what happens after Happy Ever After. We'll share our origin stories, do some shipping, rant a bit, and share reading recommendations. You should know we are now entering the spoiler kingdom, where we will spoil everything, from Once Upon a Time to Happily Ever After, including a shocking revelation. Turn back now if you haven't seen the series yet. You have been warned. Now, let's jump right in. Cue the fairy tale music. The Tenth Kingdom originally aired in February and March 2000 as a 10-hour miniseries on the American television network NBC, distributed by Hallmark Entertainment. The series took 10 years to write, $45 million to make, and over 6 months to film across several countries, including the UK, Austria, France, and Germany, which made it the most ambitious of all the fantasy miniseries the companies had made in collaboration since the mid-90s. It was called a big gamble that, unfortunately, did not seem to pay off at the time. Ratings were disappointing, starting at a then-low 14 million viewers and dropping, and reviews were mixed. Variety was scathing, calling the series self-indulgent and nonsensical, while E! Entertainment Television quipped, "There seems to be an unspoken 11th kingdom for the folks at NBC. It's called ratings hell." On the other hand, the New York Times praised it, calling it funny and wondrous, and even giving the series a cover story for the premiere. As is only appropriate, this story does have a happy ending. Sort of. Over time, the series has gone on to win an Emmy for its beautiful opening sequence, gain a small yet fiercely devoted fanbase, and herald a new era of fairy tale adaptations. In a moment, we'll discuss whether the series holds up in this new era, but first, our newbie Ashley will tell us what The Tenth Kingdom is about.
There is a lot that happens in The Tenth Kingdom, so it's hard to summarize, but I will give it my best. So essentially, you have a mundane, down-on-their-luck father and daughter from New York, and this pair crosses paths with an enchanted prince in the form of a golden retriever. Yes, you did hear that right. And this golden retriever slash prince is trying to attempt to flee his stepmother, the evil queen. The three of them get transported back to his world, a fairy tale land called the Fourth Kingdom. They're joined by a half-wolf who may or may not be working for the evil queen. It's kind of hard to tell sometimes. So this group deals with various shenanigans and hijinks of every type. There are trolls, there's prisons, there are blind woodcutters, there are magic birds, fairies and gypsies. And essentially what they're trying to do is navigate a world where the fairy tales that we're familiar with as stories are actually present in new and unexpected ways.
I think that is a perfect synopsis.
Right, I was trying to get everything
in there. And
really
encompasses the multitude of things that happen in this series.
That is an impressive summary of a 10-hour miniseries.
This is not something you can just like talk about in one sentence. No. There's no way. You need to give it a little bit more.
There's no elevator pitch here.
No.
So with that excellent and succinct summary out of the way, shall we start our origin stories?
Let's.
Let's go for it.
Okay, I'll go first and make yourselves comfortable because my 10th Kingdom origin story starts about a decade before the first episode even aired. I grew up in a bedroom that was covered in Snow White, Cinderella, and Belle posters, but by middle school, I had moved on from Disney movies to fairy tale retellings, thanks to the publication of a book called Ella Enchanted by Gail Carson Levine, which was a Cinderella retelling that instantly became my favorite book. Thanks to this book, for years, I read and watched every retelling I could get my hands on, from Robin McKinley's books to Donna Joan Appleby's to Shrek. And right in the middle of this period, The Tenth Kingdom appeared. It was promoted as a fairy tale featuring the princesses who I loved, now grown up as queens. So of course I watched it the second it aired, and of course I loved it right away. I remember going to school the day after the premiere so excited to talk about it, only to learn that everyone else in my class had watched a TV movie about JonBenet Ramsey instead. Even though I had watched it with my parents, I wouldn't meet another person who had seen The Tenth Kingdom for many years, so for a really long time this felt like something that had been made just for me. Fortunately, I had the novelization as proof of its existence. And around 2003 or so, I stumbled across a DVD set at the sale bin of a Blockbuster store. I made such a loud, weird noise when I found it that the cashier came running all the way from the front of the store over to the back to where I was to check if I was okay.
I can see this happening.
I know. I also have an origin story because I was a wee young lass once upon a time, and I loved fairy tales. I had gotten into the Grimm stories because my high school had a very nice illustrated copy of the fairy tales, so I was already a fairy tale fan, and when the 10th Kingdom was teased, I guess, I don't really remember how they went about promoting it, but in some way they must have promoted this heavily because I saw the promotions and I knew that I wanted to watch this. So I did make a point of watching it. And I loved all those NBC miniseries. It was, you know, like a movie but longer. This was before the days of what we have now, like short series and like Game of Thrones and stuff where you can kind of binge them. So this is kind of like a precursor to that. And I wanted to watch it and I was hooked right from the start. I clearly loved it. It was a fairy tale for grown-ups and that was something that really just like resonated with me. I obviously did not care for the JonBenet story because I do not have any memory of that being a thing. I convinced one of my friends to watch it. That happened. That's the only person I have ever known until I met B, who had watched The Tenth Kingdom. So that is my story.
And my origin story, as you know, is very short. They made me do it. I guess I never heard of it.
So now that we've gotten to know The Tenth Kingdom a bit, let's tackle the big question. What did you think? And perhaps more importantly, how did you feel about The Tenth Kingdom? And Ashley, as a newbie, let's start with you.
Okay, don't hate me. I'm going to continue our blue stocking circle tradition of the newbie not really loving it as much as the other two.
Our unintentional pattern.
Unintentional pattern. It was not bad. I will put it out there. It was not, by all means, not the worst thing I've ever seen. There's a lot
of praise.
There's good stuff to it. I just, as a whole, I thought that it was a little long. And maybe that's because NBC really wanted it as a 5-night 10-hour, 2 hours a night, they felt they had to put story in to fit the time schedule. I feel like had it been condensed a little bit, that would have helped. And then I'm sure we're going to talk about it. I have a lot of thoughts about certain scenes that happen, like the trial scene and Kissing Town. But I will say I thought it was really fun how they have a lot of fairy tales, but different. So it's not just, okay, Snow White's grown up, which is, that's cool. But you've got the blind woodcutter, whose name is not Rumpelstiltskin, when they have to guess his name, nor is his name Rumpel the Fourth, or the Second, or Junior. So I really like how they played with it, but it was not my favorite thing. I'm sorry, don't hurt me.
It's okay, we're not going to put you on the woodblock yet.
No. Oh, thank you.
I had not seen this since I was maybe 18, 19, and that's probably overestimating. It was probably even before that. A lot of it I had forgotten about, except for that ring. You can never forget the ring once you've seen the ring. So I had forgotten a lot of the scenes, and watching it now, there were a lot of elements and subtext that I am really troubled by, especially knowing that I was watching this as a 15-year-old girl, and it's a little horrifying, but it also not a terrible thing. I still enjoy it. I still do like it. I had that moment when I saw, like, for instance, we'll talk about it later, but like the mushroom scene, I was like, oh yeah, I love this scene. So it was nostalgic and that was fun. I had some trouble with it and we'll get into it.
I'm sure we will. As for me, it gave me this nice warm feeling of nostalgia, so I really appreciated it for that. Yes, I cringed at various moments, and I'm sure we're going to go into those scenes you mentioned, Kissing Town, and of course, the Little Lamb Village trial, but I felt like the little girl wrapped in a blanket in between her parents on the sofa again.
Aww. I think there's something, I think we're talking a little bit about it, that this is something where to really love it, you might have had to see it at a certain time in your life.
That's my hypothesis.
You had to be there.
I think you had to be there, and you had to be a certain age, you know,
8 and 18, that's my official scientific hypothesis.
I think that works. I think if you watch it for the first time between those ages, especially at that time, you know what I mean? Like, you really would have gotten sucked into it. So, yeah, now watching, you have nostalgia feeling. I think had I watched it then, I might have not noticed some of the things that I notice now that kind of put me off a little bit. So I think there's something to be said about your hypothesis. But I get the nostalgia feeling.
I can definitely see that being one of the reasons why it was such a flop at the time, because they were aiming this at adults.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a huge sense of, like, you need to suspend belief in order to get into this show. So I can see that being a lot easier for a young adult age group.
Yeah, I can see that.
Than necessarily the intended audience that they had.
So we all agree that there are certain things we found a little bit disconcerting this time watching it as adult women. Because of that, let's go ahead and switch our usual segment order and start with a feminist rant, since I'm sure there'll be lots to talk about.
First things, I had a couple problems. One of the first things I had a problem with was the trial scene. Essentially what happened, for if you guys haven't seen the miniseries yet, is they are in this shepherd's village, and one of the shepherdesses, Sally Peep, a member of that family, the Little Bo Peep family, ends up being murdered, so sad Sally. and Wolf gets put on trial for her murder because he's been acting a little crazy and he seemed to be the most likely suspect, and Virginia has to be his lawyer because no one else will go near the case. Now, Virginia is 21, a waitress. She has no idea what to do with the law, I think, and they made a point of saying it either in the Fourth Kingdom or in our world. So I will give her credit for trying her best to defend him. But one of the things that she says when she's trying to defend him is she victim blames, essentially. And she says to the judge and the jury, oh, well, Sally deserved it. She was really easy because earlier Sally had been acting a little flirtatiously, and while that is true, the fact that a woman said that another woman deserved what she got really struck me, and I don't know if that's because I watched it in the era that I did, you know, with everything going on right now, but I was not so happy with that scene.
No, I got to that point. I remember this being a very feminist work because the hero's a woman, the villain's a woman. I think they're both great characters. And I was actually concerned that we wouldn't have anything to rant about for this segment. But then I got to that town and I was like, yeah, we're going to have plenty.
I know that whole segment, and it was like a full episode almost. It went on for a while. It is just the worst thing ever. It starts with the shepherdesses just frolicking and bouncing around and being your stereotypical like 18th century shepherdess that you'll like toss into the hedges and have a go with. It's really bad. And then as soon as it starts with Wolf, his actions, his mannerisms, his behavior towards the girls, and this whole time of the month thing that starts going, it throws me off. And I had completely forgotten about that episode except for the singing part, which is like the only redeeming thing in that entire like 2-hour segment of the show. It does not work at all.
And I'm glad that you brought up the time of the month stereotype, because that kind of rubbed me the wrong way too. They must have been playing it for laughs, I think. And, you know, Wolf is saying that he gets really irritable at this time of the month, and he's really short with people, and he just wants to eat everything in sight.
And he cries at random. And
he cries at random, you know, moments. And on the one hand, I get it, but they don't portray that as being sympathetic. They portray him saying all these things as being ridiculous and no one taking him seriously. And you know what? When that happens to half the population, like, it is something that's serious with us. You know what I mean? So I kind of felt that that was a little, they might not have thought of it that way. And who knows how many women were on the producing, directing, writing
That is an interesting point.
At the time that they were making it. But I thought that was something I was like, maybe not the most PC thing to do.
I will say right now, the writer is a man, the two directors are men, and the both executive producers are men. So that
seems like
an argument for women behind the scenes.
At the very least, have like one woman copy editor or something looking over the script and being like, you know what, let's change this.
It's almost like it's trying to be comical, but at the same time, it's who is it funny for? You know, is it funny to men because this is what they assume women are like and this is what they're experiencing? And it tries to turn it on its head because Wolf's a man and then it's Virginia who's dealing with giving him sympathy. But it still just doesn't quite work because it's not satire, I don't feel. Like, it doesn't come across as, it doesn't have that, like, irony that satire does. It just comes across as offensive.
Well, there's something I want to mention. So, Ashley, when I was a kid, Wolf was my favorite character.
No!
To the extent that in my family, this movie is still known as La Película del Lobo, or the movie about the wolf. This time around, it was a completely different experience. So I wanted to get your thoughts on this character, because basically in a story like this, usually the heroine would end up with a Prince Charming character. But here, he's relegated to her pets, and the romantic hero is instead the most notorious sexual predator in all the fairy tales. And they don't alter his taste for human flesh, and they don't alter his predilection for underage girls. So as a newbie, what do you think of his character and how it works?
I actually thought he was one of my least favorite characters in the series. I did like how, like you said, they switched it. So instead of Belle, you know, the Virginia acts as the Belle character. So instead of having Belle end up with the prince, she ends up with the Gaston character because Wolf is large and hyper-masculine and hyper-sexualized. I did not find him redeeming at all. I really hated how he treated Virginia. I saw it as and this is another feminist rant that I have, a very stereotypical man sees a thing, man must have the thing, and man will do whatever he wants to do to get the thing. And in this case, the thing is a female. He sees Virginia, decides that he has to have her, even though literally 20 seconds earlier, he was trying to cook the grandmother and he was getting ready to cook her too. And then when she rightfully says, peace out, let me hit you over the head with the umbrella because I'm not having this, he says, oh my God, you're my one true love, and goes out and buys self-help books and decides that because he's read the self-help books, he now deserves her. Because there's a recurring thing where he's like reading the books and then he keeps chasing after her. Mm-hmm. My least favorite scenes is when they're in Kissing Town and Virginia is in the coffin and he's like kind of giving her this story of like Snow White. And then he tells her, oh, well, you know, he switches it from Snow White to her and says, well, you know, Virginia, like you too, like you're an ice princess. You're encased in ice. You're so cold and you need someone to warm you up, and that someone is me. And that really, really rubbed me the wrong way because I saw that as an example of a woman making her predilections very clear to the man. She has told him no, not just once here, many times. And instead of accepting that, he says, oh, well, you know what? I can't respect your choice. I'm just going to call you a frigid witch, for lack of, you know, a better word. We'll keep it PG here. And makes it so that she needs rescuing against her judgment. She might not be frigid. I don't think she is. I think she has just said, no, I'm not interested in you. Very fairly, made it very clearly. There was no leading him on. There was no nothing. So to have that scene just kind of really capped my dislike of him. No, I mean, no offense to your 12-year-old self or anything, but
12-year-old us's were not the brightest, I think, in terms of male-female relationships.
No. It was the 90s.
It was the 90s.
No, yeah, it was the 90s. And this is not at all like the only example of...
No, it's Steve Urkel syndrome, the I'm wearing you down approach to courtship, I guess.
Yeah. Yes, that's kind of what I felt like by the end. It wasn't that she really loved him.
She was tired of it.
She was tired. She's been traipsing all over the Fourth Kingdom. She's been trying to save her dad, save the prince, get back home, evade the trolls. You know what? She cannot be bothered anymore. You're here. Ugh. Which... okay, maybe many successful marriages have been built on that, but it's not as romantic as I think the writers wanted it to come across.
So I think we're firmly in the ship wars segment now. Crystal, what are your thoughts?
So we had some discussion beforehand. Some of us separately had some conversations about Kissing Town and how awful that whole scene is, and Ashley started bringing it up. There's this idea of, are they being coerced into falling in love? Mm-hmm. Is it love because it's fate? Is it love because it's a fairy tale and that's just what happens, which is what Wolf's claim is, that you just meet the one and you go for it? Or are they being drugged in some way in Kissing Town with the floating hearts?
I had in my notes Kissing Town and consent ? And then I couldn't believe that I was thinking about that at this point in my life.
No, I really thought that she was not in love with him. And I think the switch that happens at Kissing Town is not natural. I saw it as very much the water they drink or the air they breathe or whatever spell Kissing Town has. I actually did not think that the miniseries made a good case for Virginia falling in love for Wolf. I think that with the Kissing Town sequence, it made it seem as if she fell under the influence of Kissing Town, and because he was there, maybe that was the point where she kind of broke and was like, you know what, I'll just, you know, let you have your way, sort of, because I'm under all these, like you said, under the influence of drugs. So I don't know if you guys saw it that way, but I did not like the Kissing Town scene because I thought that was very much a taking away her agency and putting her under the spell of this magic.
As a child, I didn't love Wolf. When I was first watching this, like, just trying to think back, our conversation just got me thinking about it. I, as a 15-year-old, saw this very much in the line of the fairy tales, and it just happens, and it's so cute. Look at the little hearts and the little cupids, and of course you just fall in love.
And there are literal hearts.
There are literal hearts.
Yes, there are CGI hearts floating around.
It's like a Snapchat filter for TV or
something.
Yes,
that's exactly what it is.
So... looking at this now and watching it, it was a little painful to me because it is so rapey. It is non-consensual at all in many ways because so much of it is just Wolf essentially wearing her down and the whole, well, you don't know any better. You do want me because why wouldn't you want me? Because this is going to happen. And of course this is going to happen. And Virginia's reluctance eventually starting to turn is it because of whatever's in the air? Is it because inhibitions go down because Kissing Town is almost like Vegas and there's this sense of like gamble and drink? And in one scene, they are in a bar, they are drinking. That's before the epic proposal.
Yeah.
So is it because she's somehow inebriated by the air, the food? You're not supposed to drink or eat things in Fairyland. That's just that's standard trope of Fairyland. Right. So is it that? I don't know. What do you think?
I had that very question in my notes. I wasn't sure. However, I will make the argument that I do sense there's a shift before the Kissing Town events. As you pointed out, Ashley, she chooses to believe him in Little Land Village when no one does. She does appear to soften towards him, start trusting him by that third part before they even get to Kissing Town. If that hadn't happened, I would be much more hesitant. That being said, when I was a kid, I wasn't focused on the romance, and I used to fast forward past a lot of Kissing Town because I've never liked kissing books, as we talked about in our Solace episode, much less Kissing Towns. So it wasn't my focus, and then giving it more thought this time as an adult, yes, I do see that coercive aspect that you two have been mentioning. But at the same time, I think there's two ways to approach relationships in fiction. There's the standards of our world, and there are the standards of the story world. Some relationships, like Zoe and Wash in Firefly, we talked about how they pass by the standards of both our world and the world they live in. Some couples, like, say, Buttercup and Wesley from The Princess Bride, they would be a terrible idea by the standards of our world, because all they have in common is that they're both blonde and beautiful and grew up on a farm.
There's more?
But by the standards of their world, they're such an epic romance that even people who don't like kissing books are rooting for them by the end. So that's how I approach it in this way, and I think that this story, as well as Enchanted makes a point of comparing directly our world's standards to romance with the fairy tale world's standards to romance. And I think in this series, there are two characters that are coming at it from these opposite directions. One character, Wolf, is used to love at first sight, is used to marrying someone right after you meet them. That's what Snow White and Cinderella and all these characters go through. Whereas Virginia is approaching it through our eyes. For these real-world standards, they don't work, for all the reasons that you two have mentioned. But I buy it as a fairy tale standard. And again, that's probably just my nostalgia speaking. It's always been this way.
If I suspend belief enough, I can also just buy it as a fairy tale standard. And I also saw her softening towards him. I haven't seen Enchanted in a very long time, but that is Disney. And one of the things that we've talked about is how this series, it's difficult to tell whether it was appropriately intended for adults or was it originally intended for children and adults. Then they, you know, like it doesn't really work for either audience perfectly because too many elements are childlike, too many elements are too adult for children. And Enchanted is very strictly a children's story that plays with not only fairy tale tropes but Disney tropes. And I think it succeeds better at doing that fairy tale romance and keeping it clean. I know that The Tenth Kingdom wanted to be darker. I think it may have been too dark, at least looking at it now as an adult.
I will say that I think that's a really good point, the fairy tale versus real life relationship models. I think my problem too is that I've always hated the Cinderella, Snow White, Sleeping Beauty Disney movies because I hated that whole, you see him, I know, yes. I'm very much a later, you know, like Jasmine and Aladdin, she gives him attitude. And Belle like and the Beast gives him super attitude. Because that whole, you see someone across the room and it's love at first sight, I never bought that, even as a kid. And I remember sitting there looking at Cinderella, like, with my head in my hands, with this super face of, no, that's not happening. My mom was looking at me like, you're a defective girl. Like, what is wrong with you? Don't you love this? I hated it.
That's not defective. The worst part of all these movies are the princess.
But I mean, we're all broken.
I never bought into it. And don't get me started on how really the prince loves Cinderella so much, but he can't recognize her the next day. He needs to rely on a shoe. Like, she's the only one in the whole world that has
a shoe. That's what makeovers do.
That could be a whole separate episode. But I get that's a good point that, yes, from Wolf's perspective, that's what happens. And I could buy that. If I suspend belief, I could buy that. But you were saying that there was a little bit of a softening towards, on Virginia's part, towards Wolf before Kissing Town. And my issue with that is, like, yes, there was a softening, but I did not see that as a softening from I hate you to I love you and I want to have your babies. It was I hate you to, you know what, we can be friends. You are maybe not the worst person, and on top of not being the worst person, you are valuable to me. You are guiding me through this place that I know nothing about. You're trying to help my father. You're trying to get me back to my home. Just because someone treats you with respect and nicely and compassion and brings you a bunny to cuddle because you're not feeling well does not mean that they like you.
How long before or after, because now I can't remember, is the tail touching incident?
That was fairly early.
That was fairly early, yeah.
It was so squeaky and I was like, oh. So that was also all kinds of weird.
Also yeah. Creepy, yes. I it was happening as I was watching. I was like, is this really happening? Are they trying to make the analogy I think they're trying to make? Because this is supposed to be a fairy tale miniseries. Like, that was one of the bits where I was watching it and almost hoping that I wasn't seeing what I was seeing because I had no other way to categorize what I was seeing other than in a, I find this disturbing on a personal level. So yeah, this tale was weird. That line, I deserve it. You don't deserve anything for saving someone's life. You don't deserve anything for doing anything to someone else. It's called basic human decency. And that just really irritated me. And again, maybe that's because we're watching it in today's climate and it's very charged with discussions like this. But no. I mean, yes, it was the 90s, but no.
So we're heading into Catharsis Corner territory. Let's just jump right in and air out all our other feelings.
One of the aspects that kind of bothered me, kind of did, I'm not really sure how it felt about it, the whole gypsy camp scene. When it starts, even before they get to the gypsy camp, Wolf brings up the traditional gypsy Romani stereotypes. Oh, they're shifty, they can't be trusted, be careful. Did not like. When they go in, they're actually treated with respect, they're treated kindly, and I thought, okay, this is great. They're going to kind of play with that stereotype. Virginia sets free the magic birds, and while I get that she was doing a good thing in some ways, because they're sentient beings and they were being sold into slavery, those were the gypsies' main form of income. So I understand the gypsies being upset, but then the gypsies, because they're upset, end up cursing Virginia, so we come full circle back to ultimately, yes, the gypsies are shiftless and untrustworthy and kind of evil characters because they gave her this horrible curse. I did not like that. I thought maybe they were trying to play with it by kind of giving a backstory to why they cursed her. It wasn't just because, it was because she had taken away all their income for the year or whatever it was. But that whole scene just kind of didn't sit well with me. I don't know if you guys...
No, not at all. It was irredeemable. It was filled with stereotypes. And then on top of all that, they're murdered. All of them are murdered by the huntsmen, including the wolf boy. You see his corpse. It was cruel.
Yeah, it makes a point of panning right over him. The scene ends and it pans over all the bodies and sort of focuses just on the youngest child, who is the grandson of the gypsy queen, I suppose, is what she is. And he's been struck by an arrow, like straight to the heart, it looks like. And it's, I think, possibly trying to foreshadow. There was some discussion in some of the articles that we found that there was a sequel that they were planning, and having already read some of Bee's notes before watching the show, I started to think, well, maybe this is why they did that. Maybe because that sequel was supposed to show Wolf and magical human interactions. Maybe they were trying to make a case about this child being a wolf and he's one of the first people murdered on the show. I don't know. I could be stretching it, but I think that's maybe what they were trying to do, to show the hatred towards all the wolves and that no matter what, even if it's a child, they experience this kind of prejudice on top of the fact that this child was already in an outlaw camp of some sort. You assume that they're not regarded well within the Nine Kingdoms, but it's still troubling.
I'll go ahead and provide the summary here now for the sequel, although we will include it in the show notes. The sequel would have basically been, and Simon Moore, the writer, has said this several times, it would have gone back to the Nine Kingdoms, like the end of this series implies, but then it would have gone specifically to the Second Kingdom, which is where Wolf is from. It would have been more about him than about Virginia's story, like this one was, and specifically about how he and eventually his cub would have to face the issue of wolf discrimination, the three of them together. So it would have focused more on that wolf topic that you mentioned, and the discrimination against them, against their half-species, I suppose.
Yeah.
I don't know if this scene was necessarily foreshadowing that eventual sequel.
Well, that's interesting because that brings to mind Zootopia, that animated Disney film from last year, and how it was actually an allegory for like race relations. There were a lot of think pieces generated about that. If that's the case, it sounds a little similar, where okay, you have a half wolf, so if the half wolves and or full wolves are being discriminated against, and it kind of seemed that way, where the writers, you know, where the producers trying to make some kind of statement on race relations in the Nine Kingdoms and by extension our world.
I also really love Zootopia. Yes. That's a really good movie. Now, I think Zootopia does that really well because it is using allegory with animals, but it does it in a very appropriate way. Now, there has also been a lot of talk recently, especially with J.K. Rowling and a few other fantasy writers and fantasy series, where they are representing either homosexuality or race relations through something else. So, for instance, J.K. Rowling has come out saying that Lupin's werewolfism is a metaphor for homosexuality. The fan response has been, well, why didn't you just depict homosexuality in your story instead of, like, this after-the-fact random tweet that you send out about Dumbledore being gay? Mm-hmm. So if you really wanted to depict, you know, LGBTQ relations within the community, why didn't you just actually go out and do that? And it's a similar thing here where you have, if you're trying to depict race relations with the werewolves, but then you have actual races, why aren't you just doing it with what's there? Why show the gypsies in the stereotypical way? The trolls as the only real characters of color that you have in the series. There's background characters of color in the New York scenes.
And the Nine Kingdoms as well.
What's there? In the ball. There are a couple of people, yeah.
And some of the servants in Wendell's castle.
But then but non-speaking they're all roles. Background characters or non-speaking roles, and your actual speaking characters of color are either, you know, kind of just comedic and don't really do much else. So it's still troubling, you know, if you want to depict racism. It's a real thing.
That's totally fair, but I have to say I do kind of love the trolls.
I still love the trolls too.
I am surprised. I like them too, but one of the complaints of the series are the trolls.
I think they were comic relief, and I more than that, I liked how they actually seemed to depict a very real relationship amongst siblings. My brother and sister and I will fight with each other like that. And I was like, oh, okay, yes, makes sense. I actually also loved how they were half siblings, because the dad makes a point of saying your mom's plural will be ashamed of you. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. Traditionally, in fairy tale stories, you don't have half siblings really liking each other. You have this competition, which one is going to be the heir to the throne, or which one is the best. So the fact that the three of them kind of bonded together and made their own family group, I actually really enjoyed that. I thought they were fun. I wish they weren't golden statues for a large chunk of it. Three quarters of it. Yeah, but I liked them. And they were very rational in many ways. Why? We can't be stuck in a matchbox. Where are the matches? I would never have thought that. I'd be panicking and be like, we're going to die, we're going to die. So the fact that they were able to think that through, I appreciate that.
I love their moments. I think they have some of the best moments in the series.
I did too. The boat when they're singing.
They come up with the best reasons why the 10th Kingdom is the 10th Kingdom and this magic box with this song. They are the best.
I really like them.
Ashley, I am both surprised and relieved to hear there was something about this you actually liked. So while you're in this positive spirit, let's just go full fangirl and talk about the things we liked about the series. If there were any other things that you liked?
No, I mean, there was a lot of comedy, the trolls, Tony and Wendell, especially in the latter half of it, like their relationship. I loved at the beginning, so it was kind of like, Tony, you're a creep, and Virginia would be better off leaving you in the Ten Kingdoms. But you can tell that he loves her. He just got thrown into a situation he didn't know how to deal with when he was younger. He's really funny. His deadpan kind of like, what is wrong with you people? Why can't you just do a thing? Why do you have to threaten death before I get, you know, a cup to go drink water? That reaction, which is kind of every man's reaction, I think, if they actually were placed in these situations, I really enjoyed it. So I thought Tony was really great.
How about the toad?
The toad riddle. I love the toad. Yes. You know what? Why are you here? And he solved it. You know what I mean? Like, that was one of the parts where I was like, okay, yes. I had to watch, you know, like 5 episodes, but I got here, and that was a great scene.
That scene reminds me a lot of, I don't know if you guys, I mean, you've probably seen it, Labyrinth.
Yes.
So there's that one scene where she comes up against the doors, and it's the playing card doors. There's like, one door leads to the center, one door leads to certain death. And I'm like, this is what would have happened.
I also liked, I have to give Virginia and the costumers full points.
A plus.
Yeah.
This woman was walking around in combat boots for the entirety of it. She had, before her hair was cut off, she had it in a ponytail. She found a long coat somewhere that was very practical for sleeping in the woods and protecting yourself from, you know, splinters and branches. I really appreciated that because that's one of the few times that I could actually believe that a character could spend 10 hours running around a story dressed the way she was and have it make sense to the story.
Absolutely. That's my absolute favorite adventuring costume of any fantasy series. That's what I would choose to wear.
It's very practical. Heroine costume as opposed to what you usually see heroines depicted as.
Yes, and none of the, you know, like corsets, skirts. Mm-hmm. It made sense. She was in combat boots. It even made sense in the story. She was going to work.
What did you think of Virginia besides her costume?
I liked her as a person. I thought she was maybe in line with her footwear. She was very practical. She was very single-minded. She wanted to get home, but she didn't let that, like, she took care of Wolf. She didn't let that one goal overtake everything. She had tantrums. My issue with her, and I don't think it's her, I think it's a fault of the writers, was I didn't like how it sometimes seemed to fluctuate between her being presented as the chosen one, that she was destined to do this, and her being presented as someone who was just in the right place in the right time, and this happened to her, and she managed to do what she did because of her innate skills. She is who she is. And I think had they chosen to emphasize one road or the other, I would have liked it better, because they're kind of going back and forth, because there were cues for both. When she's talking to Snow White, she, you know, Snow White tells her, you're on the edge of greatness, you have this destiny, and she's like, I don't believe it. Okay, that kind of seems to be like, you have been destined to do this. But then a lot of time it was, no, she just happened to be riding through Central Park, and if Wendell had jumped through another mirror that didn't lead to the 10th Kingdom, none of this would have happened. You know what I mean? So I kind of feel that that was something that I had an issue with, but I think that's a more story character as opposed to a story issue as opposed to a character with Virginia. Because I really like Virginia.
I always liked her as a heroine.
I like her too. And I'll throw in a tidbit from the novelization. This was a deleted scene, I suppose. The Snow White Virginia conversation is much longer in the book than it is in the series. And one of the things that Snow White tells her is that she's been guiding her the whole time. So Snow White is the woman in the woods that asked for the sandwiches in disguise. Snow White is the little Cupid girl in Kissing Town in disguise as well. That's why she's so helpful both times. She's sort of leading Virginia onto this path to get her to do eventually what she wants, which is to defeat the evil queen. So I'm not so much on the destiny side, as this is someone who had the ability to get close to the queen that no one else would because of their relationship, and that Snow White has sort of been using her as a pawn for her own ends. So it's more like, in my impression, guiding her to do this thing than she being destined to do this thing.
Okay, I like knowing that a lot, because then I feel much better about her character. I feel like, okay, this happened to her if any of us had fallen into the Fourth Kingdom.
A girl can dream.
I'll stay in the 10th Kingdom, you know, you have fun with the trolls. But I like that, because then had it happened to any of us and we had been chosen by Snow White, we could have done the same thing. So I think that that's something that maybe should have been in the miniseries, because that would have added more weight towards she is every girl and she just happens to fall into this and she does it because she's getting help, but anyone could have been helped in her place. So I like that. I feel like the miniseries maybe should have included that and not just kept it in the novelization. Not that I'm a producer, I'm just, you know, I'm backseat producing.
I think there's a lot that happens in this movie, especially because it is trying to be a fairy tale adaptation, is it free will versus fate? Because there's also that one scene in jail before Tony escapes, and he's with the guy, there's Acorn and the other guy.
Clayface.
Like the character in Batman. And he gives him a little statue. It looks like he carved it out of stone or something. It says, the four who will save the nine kingdoms, or it's predestined almost. So is that also Snow White, or is that something, are they also manipulating Tony? Is it just chance? Is it fate? Is it just a fairy story and things just happen?
I would love for it to be Snow White, because that was one of my other things, unresolved plot points. Clayface comes in, he gives them the statue, he sails away, he's never seen again, and the statue gets thrown in the river. So what's going on? Was it just to kind of like put that seed in Tony's mind that they are going to be heroes? So I think that knowing that, in my head, now Clayface has become Snow White.
I will throw in a tidbit from the novelization, another one. Originally, it was Clayface they met in the swamp. It wasn't Acorn, but they still didn't explain the statuette. So let's go with it. It was Snow White the whole time.
Always blame it on Snow White.
Actually, I wanted to ask you, what did you think about the relationship between Virginia and the Queen? And this is a huge spoiler that we haven't said yet. So if you haven't seen the series, this is when you need to stop.
Okay, so if you have seen the series, I had no idea that she was going to be Virginia's mom. I gobsmacked, I paused it, and I was like, you know what? I don't have time to rewatch it all up to this point, but I was trying to go back and think, was this foreshadowed? Was I just sleeping through all those points? I did not see that coming. not even left field, like left galaxy. Pluto was where that came from. I don't know if you guys saw it coming, but...
Not when I was a kid. That was one of those it was Quirrell moments for me when I had no idea that was going to happen.
I can't remember if I read into it or not. Watching it again, obviously, I knew that it was coming.
And it's also the Disney trope. There's the dead or missing mom. So you kind of expect that from the beauty character in this Beauty and the Beast tale she's living out.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's normal. So I thought that's how they were just setting it up. That Virginia would have had a harder time escaping if there had been two parents. I did not think that the missing mom was going to come back as such an integral plot point to the finale of it. So well done. Something else I liked. That was a very well executed plot twist.
All right. I want to ask you, favorite scene?
I'm going to say it's the trolls in the elevator. We're in a matchbox. We can't be in a matchbox. Where are the matches? That just spoke to me on many different levels.
So I have two favorite scenes. And the first one is also the trolls. And it's when they discover the radio, which is like the magic box that sings
with the about brothers
a fever. Kid. It's a fever that only strikes on a Saturday night. The other scene that I love, and I loved it as a kid too, and another scene I love. Maybe I liked it more than I remembered. So one is the mushrooms, as I mentioned. Don't eat the mushrooms, don't drink the water. I love that scene, and it kind of like made me a fan of A Whiter Shade of Pale. So
when it got to that point, I didn't remember it. Actually, I thought, she's going to murder me. She's going to murder me that I'm making her watch a movie with singing mushrooms.
You know, at that point, I just become so inured to the ridiculousness that happens before the kingdoms. I was like, it makes sense that the mushrooms are singing. Because what else? I had no...
Like, you know what goes good with omelet? Mushrooms.
It required no suspension of belief for me to accept that as part of their journey.
Just
so,
go with the flow by that
I
point.
Love that scene. And then the other scene that I really like was when Virginia's hair grew when she was cursed. I loved Rapunzel as a kid, and I thought it was hilarious because when Wolf asks, you know, he asks her to toss her hair over the side of that tower tree she's in, and he starts pulling it. She starts screaming, and he's like, "I've always wanted to do this." It's like, well, of course that would hurt like crazy. So.
I appreciated that. Yes, it wasn't just throw down your hair, and then she's just chilling on the top. No.
She's like screaming and yanking it back.
Yes. Again, I appreciate the verisimilitude of that scene. That was also well done.
So I'm going to cheat and say that my favorite scene is everything from when Wolf rescues Virginia from the trolls and he comes swinging in on that rope, all the way up to right before Little Lamb Village. So I guess part two and the very first part of part three in the 5-part version. That's my favorite scene.
Skip over the bad parts.
There was also one scene that I did not remember at all, and that made me squeal in delight. And that was the mice, when they showed up talking about Cinderella's and the coronation.
That was a really cute scene.
Cinderella was probably my favorite Disney movie when I was a kid, so I loved it.
That's another one up there.
Well, the talking mice were the best part of the Cinderella film, so that makes sense that you had that nostalgic feeling.
I think they did a good job with very minor characters.
Yes,
and
definitely.
Their involvement in the story.
Yeah, Juliet, the woodcutter. Yes. The name is not... When you have to guess a name, you're obviously going to think it's Rumpelstiltskin. And it wasn't.
And the Tooth Fairy.
And the Tooth... Yes, I actually... That's a good point. The supporting characters and the minor characters, I think, were maybe the best parts of it.
I think so.
So I'm almost afraid to ask, but are we ready to rate this?
I'll go last.
No, go first. You're the newbie. Oh,
okay.
It's like a Band-Aid. Pull it off.
I think I want to give it a 2.5 sock. Because, again,
it's not bad. It is a 10-hour movie.
It's a 10-hour movie, and I'm giving it 2.5 because I didn't hate it. If I had hated it, I would have given it a 1 or a 2, but I wouldn't watch it again, and I think that's going to be my minimum for a 3, that I liked it enough to watch it again. So, yes. Final answer, 2.5 socks.
Crystal?
So when I first watched this as a kid, I would have given it a 5 because I loved it. I was a huge fan. Watching it now as an adult in retrospect and being smarter, wiser, and more critical of all the things, I probably will also give it a 2.75.
Just round up.
I still like it. I still enjoy it. I do think it has problematic issues, and I felt some scenes dragged on, so there were some scenes where I was losing interest and kind of like doing other things at the same time. But then I was still charmed by all the stuff that I loved when I was younger, so it's still good.
For the record, middle school me would have given this 10 out of 5 socks. A++, 104%. Current me is going to give it 4 out of 5 socks.
This is not high art, but it's still enjoyable.
Exactly.
So I think averaging out, it comes to a 3?
I would say that's fair.
That's a good number.
And you know what? That's on the positive side, because it's three rounds to positive. So I think everyone can sleep easy tonight knowing that it was a above average.
I still haven't ruled out putting you on the wooden block.
No.
So are we ready for the reading recs? Because I have a lot.
Me too. So I think we should jump right into it.
After all these years, fairy tale fantasy is still my favorite genre, so there are 1,001 works I want to recommend, but I've managed to narrow it down to just a few, starting with two of the retellings I mentioned in my origin story, Ella Enchanted by Gail Carson Levine and Beauty by Robin McKinley, based on Cinderella and Beauty and the Beast, respectively. Both books are suitable for all ages. If you like the 10th Kingdom miniseries, check out the novelization I've been mentioning throughout the episode, for extra scenes and character insights. In its introduction, the series executive producer writes, "If you want to read something else like The Tenth Kingdom, well, there isn't anything else like it." He's right, I've spent over half my life looking. Fortunately, there are a couple of works that come pretty close. Number one on that list is my favorite and sadly not ended comic series, Fables by Will Willingham, which is as close to The Tenth Kingdom as you'll ever get, right down to the main ship. It's about fairy tale characters who are exiled from their Nine Kingdoms-like homeland and take refuge in New York City. Fables has several spin-off series worth reading as well, and I especially recommend Fairest, which focuses on the series' wonderful female characters. I also want to mention The Book of Lost Things by John Connolly, which has a lot in common with The Tenth Kingdom, but with a young male protagonist, a World War II setting, and a more somber tone. I should probably note, unlike the previous recommendations, both of these works, especially Fables, are definitely intended for mature audiences, so you might want to wait a long while before handing them to the kid in your life. Lastly, I have to recommend The Princess Bride by William Goldman, partly because it's also a modern fairy tale with roots in New York City, but mostly because it's my favorite book of all time. I find it inconceivable that someone hasn't already seen the rightfully adored 1987 movie adaptation, but go do so now if you haven't. Oh, and if you get the chance, go see Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods at a theater near you.
I'll recommend The Girl Who Circumnavigated in Fairyland in a Ship of Her Own Making, it's a long title, by Catherine M. Valenti. September is the girl, the titular girl. She's delighted when she's invited to Fairyland, but she arrives to find it in a bit of a shambles, to put it politely, and she sets out to restore her order. One of my favorite characters ever is in this book, her companion A through L, a wyvern who thinks that his absent father was a library, which makes him a wyverary, a wyvern and library hybrid. He's adorable. Also, Stardust by Neil Gaiman, if you haven't read it, is one of my favorites. It's all about the adventures of Tristan, a young man from the village of Wall, which borders the magical land of Fairy, and a fallen star. It's fantastic either in book or movie form.
I wish I had written those two books. They're so good. They're one of my
amazing.
Favorites.
Yep.
So I second all of those recommendations. I am a huge fan of Beauty. That was what my graduate thesis was on. So I can talk about Beauty for days. And I love Stardust. I love all these things. I haven't read The Girl Circumnavigated Fairyland, but it's been on my TBR for a while. So
do
I
it.
Will get to it.
Move
it
to the top now.
I will move it to the top now. So my recommendations, firstly, Uprooted by Naomi Novik.
I love that book.
And
mm-hmm.
I love that book. I read it. And as soon as I read it, I came to B and was like, you must read this book because it is life. I love anything having to do with the magic of gardens, that plant green magic. And it has one of my favorite ships, I would say, of the dark taciturn man and adventurous girl type of relationship. So it's one of my favorites. Princess Bride, love it too. For a darker take on a fairy tale fantasy, I had a hard time coming up with something similar to The Tenth Kingdom that had not been recommended already. So I kind of pulled some strings here. I think Tithe, A Modern Fairy Tale by Holly Black, is good if you like that feeling of going from a modern urban setting into this world of danger and darkness and fairies. It's not at all like The Tenth Kingdom in essence, but it has that feeling of magic and being thrown into a land that you're not familiar with. It is about Seelie and Unseelie courts. It's very, very driven by fairy lore, so it's one of my favorites. And I'd like to give a quick nod to The Last Unicorn and Legend for spinning their own fairy tale magic. Both of these are some of my favorites. Obviously, read the originals if you're interested in fairy tales. There's countless editions of Grimm's, Andrew Lang, Hans Christian Andersen. There's fairy tales from all over the world. Go out there and find them. And Once Upon a Time is the most obvious 10th Kingdom recommendation. So if you're looking for something like that as far as a series, you might enjoy The 10th Kingdom and vice versa.
And there are so many works over recent years that can trace their roots back to The 10th Kingdom. So if you like any of those, go watch the original. That concludes this episode of the Blue Stocking Circle podcast. For the show notes, visit thebluestockingcircle.com. Find us on Twitter, Tumblr, Instagram, Pinterest, and pretty much everywhere at Blue Sock Circle. That's Blue, S-O-X, Circle. Email us at thebluestockingcircle@gmail.com and join the conversation.
Cheers!
When I told my mom I was watching this, she's like, ese lobo es un pervertido.
That was her main memory of this thing. Ese lobo.